fact, our next speaker, Dr. Phillips Oxhorn, encourages this idea by focusing on the active participation of the poor as the foundation for effective democratic governance. Let me give a brief introduction of our next speaker. Dr. Oxhorn is the founding director of the McGill Center for Developing Area Studies and the executive editor of the international journal Latin American Research Review. His research focuses on the comparative study of civil society and its role in supporting democratic regimes, particularly in Latin America. Author of Organizing Civil Society, The Popular Sectors and Struggling for Democracy in Chile, Dr. Oxhorn is currently completing a manuscript titled Sustaining Civil Society, Economic Change, Democracy, and the Social Construction of Citizenship in Latin America. He has lectured extensively in the Americas, Western Europe, and Australia, and has worked as a consultant to the Inter-America Development Bank, CEDA, the International Development Research Center, the Ford Foundation, the Carter Center, and the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, and the Canadian Foundation for the Americas. As you can see, the second speaker, Dr. Oxhorn, is going to also be a treat to listen to.
Thank you. And so I'm going to be talking about research, but it's research on people who do things, so maybe I'm crossing over into the world of the Right Honorable Mr. Clark. As you can see, the title of my talk is on Organization as Empowerment, the Role of the Poor in Making Democracy Work. And I think it's important to emphasize that if democracy is going to work, it has to be inclusive. And when you look at developing countries, by definition, the majority is often poor. And so if we're going to talk about meaningful democracies, it's very important that we talk about how democracy relates or doesn't relate to people who are in situations of poverty. Now, a lot of what I'm going to be talking about comes from my work in Latin America. It's directly relevant to other countries like South Africa, where you have similar levels of economic development and urbanization. But I think the lessons have a lot to do with everywhere. And in fact, there are many parallels, at least indirectly, with what Mr. Clark was saying about Canada and the way I think democracy needs to work better for poor people in most of Latin America. And by way of introduction, I came to this during the 1980s when I was doing research for my doctoral dissertation in the slums of Chile under the Pinochet military regime. And as you can see, for me, what I discovered was what I call the rebirth of civil society, because Chile had a long history of civil society prior to the military coup in 1973. And it took a number of years to get it going again. And what I found to be most important about that experience was that it was often the necessity of being poor and trying to cope in a situation not only where there were no political or civil rights, but where economic recession, if not depression, was driving more and more people into abject poverty. And so what was happening is that people were learning slowly but surely that if they pooled their limited resources together, if they formed organizations, they could begin to better tackle their most immediate needs. And this ultimately led to a major series of mobilizations throughout the country that helped usher in a transition to democracy. And it did that in a very simple reason. What people learned by being part of these organizations is that there was something greater. There was a public good, or maybe even worse, there was a public problem. And so just as an anecdote, I went to one slum in Chile in 1986, and I talked to a woman. She was about 18 or 19 years old, had two kids, which is not atypical in Latin America. And she said basically this: you know, I thought my husband was a lazy bum because he couldn't get a job. So I was forced basically to go to the soup kitchen as the only way to get food on the table for my two children. And then I realized that it wasn't necessarily my husband. I mean, I don't know. I never met the man. But what I realized was that everybody's husband was in the same situation, that this was a problem, that the economy needed to be reinvigorated, restarted, and that it needed new and different policies. And so what this young woman really learned, not because she was looking for it, but because it hit her right in the face, was that political change had to come to Chile. And so a number of people went through similar processes of transformation, learning the value and usefulness of organizing to meet immediate needs, but also to press for change and to make societies more equal, more inclusive, and ultimately more democratic. And what it comes from is something that I call the social construction of citizenship. But in a nutshell, what it means is that people define what it means to be a citizen. So just another example from what's going on today. And several years ago, Evo Morales won the presidency of Bolivia. He's the first indigenous leader to ever win the presidency of Bolivia in a country where the majority are indigenous. And not only did he win the presidency, but he won by an overwhelming majority. And what that did immediately is it empowered people who recognized themselves as being a member of the indigenous population by saying, yeah, we've arrived. What it meant for the first time in almost 200 years of independence, that what it meant to be a Bolivian also meant that you could be indigenous and be proud of that. And so at the symbolic level, the empowerment was really right in your face when you just walked down the street of La Paz or really any city in Bolivia. And so what that also means, too, this idea of the social construction of citizenship, is that the strength of civil society is key. That when people organize and are able to represent themselves, when they're basically able to define these are our interests, and on that basis enter into negotiations with other groups, including the state, as to what should be better public policies, what it means to be a citizen of any particular country, etc., the outcome is much more inclusive, much more equal, and I would argue much more democratic. And, you know, the obvious example that really brings the point home is the women's movement. You know, in countries like Canada, the United States, all of Western Europe, citizens were equal under the law for decades, if not longer. And what the women's movement did across the West, and then later in Latin America, Africa, and other countries, they said, no, equality under the law needs to be understood from a gendered perspective. And that if women aren't organized and representing themselves, if they're not there at the bargaining table, then that equality on paper is really fictitious in practice. And so it's a new way of looking at equality that really underscores the point that I'm trying to make. If people can't organize themselves and be represented in these political processes, then they're more likely or not to be excluded, either deliberately or accidentally. And I argue, what I want to suggest is that this is the foundation of democratic governance, that the strength and richness of Canadian democracy has a lot to do with the strength and richness of its civil society. So that rights are granted and recognized, so that people of different segments, different religions, different backgrounds can all feel part of the process because they participate in the process. And in Latin America and many other new democracies, this is what's weakest, the ability of civil societies to organize themselves so that they can play a fundamental role in deepening or making democracy better. Now, as a starting point, what you need to have is an enabling environment, creating the kind of environment where civil society must or can grow. The state, in particular, must be open to working with civil society. Authoritarian states, by definition, are closed. That's why it's very difficult to imagine any kind of level of equality and inclusion unless you have a state that's willing and able to work with society, that creates the kinds of institutions that reach out and pull up from the bottom to the top the different elements of civil society. It also means that states, to a certain degree, have to be transparent, because if you don't know what's going on inside the state, it's very, very difficult to ensure that your interests are being defended, much less to press for change. It also, in many cases, requires assistance from the state, particularly for disadvantaged groups. And in fact, I think one of the reasons why Canadian democracy is as rich and strong as it is because many organizations of civil society are actually funded by the Canadian government so that they can better represent themselves, better organize themselves, with a key caveat that they retain their autonomy, that they get the money, but they're not told by the state, this is what you need to do. Now, much of the work on civil society often talks about trust and social capital. And while it would be great if everybody trusted each other, in many developing countries, particularly new democracies coming out of periods of protracted authoritarian rule or worse, trust is almost impossible to imagine. But I think there's also an irony here, too, and that is one of the best ways to get people involved in politics, to get them to realize it's important to participate, is the lack of trust. Why? Because if you trusted everybody, you wouldn't care who was making the decision. It's the recognition that you need to be there that is often the greatest incentive to try and be present if the context permits. also in this idea, too, is that civil society is not conflict-free. In fact, one of the key roles that civil society plays wherever it exists is mediating conflict. It's a way in which people who are different can come to get together, to come to get along, to look for mutual interests, common concerns, and agree to disagree in a peaceful way. That's why it's called civil society. It's not banal to say it's civil because people aren't killing each other. It's actually one of the biggest challenges in many new democracies and many developing countries in general. Now, while democracy is not a prerequisite for civil society, otherwise it wouldn't have been reborn under authoritarian Chile, it is necessary to allow civil society to reach its maximum strength and be sustainable. It's the rights that we often take for granted, basic civil rights, basic social rights, basic political rights that really provide the necessary seedbed in which democracy can not only thrive, but in which it could be driven from the bottom up through civil society and its own organizations. Now, the last thing I want to say, though, in this regard, too, is that civil society participation has to be seen as relevant. In other words, you know, it's one thing to say I've got to be at the table because I don't trust the people who are there to represent me, but it's another thing to say that if I go to the table, it will result in anything that's useful to me. I remember in the mid-1990s, I was in a meeting in El Salvador of a civil society group, and they spent literally half of the meeting explaining why it was important to be there, which tells you something, because if they have to spend half the meeting explaining why it's important to be there, they're not able to get much done. In fact, one of the clear benefits of being there was that poor people got some food. And so it's important to make people realize not only that they have an interest in being there, but if they're there, they're listened to, and that their voice will count. That it's not a meaningless waste of time, that it actually is worth the effort. And when you're living in poverty, the effort is often greater because the pressing needs of a day-to-day existence are that much greater. And so what I want to do in the rest of my talk is talk about three examples of where civil society involvement is crucial to solving key problems that people face on a daily basis. That's the relevance. And the key is to making it clear and creating the kind of environment where civil society's input will play the positive role that it needs to play. The first example is dealing with criminal violence. Now, in Latin America, but not only in Latin America, the transitions to democracy have coincided with a wave of criminal violence. There are a lot of reasons for it. Some people say, well, it's the freedom and liberty of democracy, but I don't think that's really the problem. I think the problem has something to do with the nature of the states, the nature of legal institutions, and the nature of the economy. Or economic instability, which is rampant in Latin America, means that people are forced to find solutions through criminality. Now, what's important about this is that this wave of criminal violence often assumes that the poor are the primary sources, that the burglaries, the robberies, the violent crimes are really being done by poor people, if not out of desperation, simply because they have nothing to lose. But what we often forget, and this is very important, is that while in the newspapers everywhere, when people of renown, of people of resources, of privilege are the victims of crime, that's what we see. But on a day-to-day basis, on an everyday, this is the life that people live kind of thing, the real big victims of crime are the poor themselves. And they're the victims of crime for a lot of reasons, including the fact that much of the criminal violence takes place in the slums where the poor live, but also because when you live at the margin, even losing a little bit can make a huge difference. And so what often happens is that the poor are seen as the cause of the crime, and we forget that they're often the victims. Now, one of the reasons, as I said, for the rise of crime under democracy in a lot of countries is the weakness of basic institutions of policing and courts. And so what emerges under this is the iron fist. You know, it's a de facto, if not de jure, and sometimes it actually is legislated in, criminalization of poverty through the suspension of civil rights. In other words, if you're poor, if you look different, you're assumed to be likely to be guilty. And so what we see in many Latin American countries, and not only in Latin America, under democratic regimes, are the equivalent of the old death squads that were the tools of authoritarian regimes to deal with the political opponents. And now they're being used to deal with people who are poor, who may cause crimes, or for whatever reason people just don't trust and like them. The paradox of this, the important and at the same time tragic fact, is that these draconian laws often receive high levels of public support. That's why it's important to remember that the victims of crime are more often than not the poor. In other words, people are willing to support the criminalization of their own poverty as a last resort defense mechanism. If you can't trust the police, if you can't trust the courts, then maybe the iron fists, the equivalent of the old death squads, will solve the problem. If not by deterring it, it will make sure there's no more recidivism. And so in El Salvador in the mid-1990s, the same time that I was there at the meeting where people talked about why it's important to be there, another phenomenon was taking place, and that is that almost all of the political parties were supporting constitutional changes that basically removed basic civil protections for anybody who looked poor. And it was widely popular because it was seen as the only way to deal with crime in a context where you couldn't trust the police, you couldn't trust the tribunals, basically didn't trust democracy to do so in a democratic way. And the irony is that it was so obvious and so blatant what was going on, the Salvadorian Supreme Court, hardly the paragon of democratic virtue, said enough is enough, you can't do this. That's how bad it got. And so what's the solution? If it's not the iron fist, it actually is community involvement. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that when you bring the community in, a lot can get done. I mean, first of all, if police aren't in the communities, then they're never going to be trusted. And if you have the draconian policies that essentially criminalize poverty, you create a vicious cycle in which people are more and more reluctant to trust the police, more and more distant, which means it's more and more likely that you're going to see coercive actions as the only way to deal with a real problem. But on the other hand, when you have community policing, police are on the corner, they know what's going on, people aren't afraid to talk to them, and so crimes get reported. And obviously, if crimes aren't reported, you can't solve them. But even more than that, civil society involvement can help prevent crimes. Having the police working with people in society means that the police are more likely to know when something is about to happen and can intervene when things remain relatively low level. And even more importantly, and there are very good experiments coming out of South Africa in this regard, communities can resolve conflicts at the beginning through various schemes of alternative justice to prevent the escalation that leads to the crimes and the violence that we all deplore. So by bringing in the society, by working in the society, not only do you strengthen democracy because people are included, you also have the benefit of dealing with a real problem. The second example that I'll talk about is education. You know, in the 60s, it used to be that through education, sending your kids to primary and secondary school, that was the key to social mobility. And in Latin America, over a quarter of the population actually rose in their economic and social status from 1960 through the end of the 1970s, largely because they were able to go to primary school and secondary school, learn to read and write, and get a better job than their parents had. What's happening now, though, is just the opposite. What's happening is that public education is becoming a mechanism for segmenting society rather than equalizing it and allowing for social mobility. And the reason for that is very simple, and it creates a kind of vicious cycle. On the one hand, people with resources, or relatively more resources than the poor, now have more alternatives to go to in terms of private education at the primary and secondary level, which means that more their own money is raising the quality of that education at the same time that the people with the resources are indirectly, if not directly, underfunding the public sector, which they no longer use. And so people without resources have no recourse other than to go to the public sector. Chilean president or former president commented a few years ago is that, you know, back in the 60s when I was a young man and even before, all the great Chilean leaders went to public schools. But that's not the case anymore. So on the one hand, what's happening is that people with more resources are getting a better education, which means that they're going to get better jobs. And at the other hand, the underfunded, under-resourced public system, really, believe it or not, it oftentimes you're wasting your time in going. And so what happens is that people don't complete because they realize you have more to gain by dropping out of school rather than spending 4 years in high school and not really getting any more income in the end. And very quickly, what the evidence shows is that when communities are involved in curriculum, when there's a bit of accountability, et cetera, they know that their future depends on their children. And the quality of education goes up, even if the resources don't necessarily go up. They're just spent better. The last example, because I'm running out of time, that I'll talk about is probably the most famous, which is why I left it for last. It's public works expenditures. One of the key defining characteristics of poverty is you don't have paved roads, you don't have sanitation, you don't have fresh water, you don't have electricity, the schools aren't built where you live, etc. And the famous participatory budgeting process in Porto Alegre succeeded because what it allowed people to do is decide where the funds would be spent. So for the first time, roads were being paved where the majority lived, schools were being built where poor people lived, hospitals were being built, etc. Now it's important, and this is something that we often don't realize, is that it almost failed. The Workers' Party won on a campaign of participatory budgeting. They implemented a set of institutions, and nobody went. Rather than just change course completely or not change course, the party then began to negotiate with civil society. Reforms were made. It became relevant. So not only were more and more people participating, but the civil society was growing and becoming stronger. Because it was relevant, people can see the benefit. And the irony is it's really cheap. Porto Alegre spends about $200 per capita on capital expenses. So it's not a lot of money, but the payoffs can be very, very good. And the spillover effects of a stronger civil society more generally are really very evident. So by way of conclusions, first of all, the basic problems of poverty and inequality that we see throughout the developing world cannot be solved without civil society's participation. First of all, civil society has to take ownership. They have to be able to trust schools. They have to be able to trust the police. But even more important, they need to set the priorities. And in fact, one of the key characteristics that really makes democracy such a positive force is that the priorities are set by the people who have to bear the consequences. Second of all, when states don't have capacity, it's through civil society that they can reach out. They can make resources go farther. I mean, if the soup kitchen helped that young woman in Chile 20 years ago, imagine what soup kitchens can do when governments are more concerned with helping the poor. It's a way of making resources arrive to those most in need. Basically, what it means is that democracy can be deepened. It becomes more inclusionary, more equal. It doesn't eliminate conflict, but it provides the mechanisms through which those conflicts can be mediated before they become explosive. And that here is the Latin American paradox. I think I have a couple of... Yeah, really quickly. The paradox is very simple. More Latin Americans believe in democracy than ever before. And there's similar evidence coming out of this from Africa as well. But people are not happy with the democracies that are elected. In other words, they like democracy, but they don't like what they're getting. And it's a paradox because it's managed, in some cases, 20, 30 years to exist despite that. But it's also a challenge. And the challenge is to take advantage of the opportunities before they're lost. And I'll just end with the very tragic consequences of what happened in Honduras during the summer, when, for the first time, a president was ousted by the military, and it looks like the military is going to get away with it. What it means is that these opportunities can be more ephemeral than we want. But when they're lost, it becomes very, very difficult to build the kinds of civil societies, to create the kinds of systems where states work with civil societies that can go to the root problems of inequality, poverty, and injustice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Oxhorn. I think you'll agree that the concept of social construction of citizenship was an interesting one, and the call for community activism was one that we're going to be able to connect with the first speaker.